the Tell El Tufar neighborhood. Fresh attacks were also reported in Beit Lahia and El Maghazi refugee camp. Medical sources in Gaza Strip say during the past 24 hours, hospitals have received 8 bodies recovered from under the rubble. The death toll from the genocidal war since October 2023 has risen above 70,120. More than 171,000 others have also been injured. Moti Abu Musabe joined us earlier from Deir al-Bala with the latest update on Israeli attacks in the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli violations of the ceasefire agreement are still ongoing. More airstrikes were carried out in the southern parts of Gaza Strip. Many of them were carried out in the eastern side of Rafah City. In addition to that, the eastern section of Khan Yunis City was under heavy bombings of the Israeli fire jets, in addition to the Israeli artillery strikes as well. And here in the central area of Gaza Strip, the Israeli occupation forces also continued their mass shooting towards Palestinian people who are taking shelter in the eastern sides of Al Buraij refugee camp, leaving several Palestinian casualties. And when it comes to Gaza City, the Israeli attacks are still ongoing with no sign of abating. We are talking about more Palestinian residential buildings that were demolished and destroyed by the Israeli occupation forces, coupled with the extensive gunfire towards the Palestinian people in At-Tufah neighborhood, which is still one of the focal points of the genocidal and repetitive violations of the ceasefire agreement. I would like to remind you once again that since this ceasefire agreement came into effect, the Israeli violations have exceeded 600, as you know, flagrant violations of the ceasefire agreement, and this toll and this record is still going up, because we are talking about a real intensification of those attacks against various parts of Gaza.
Among the ruins of Gaza's academic institutions, students have begun returning to what remains of their campuses, trying to challenge the Israeli systematic campaign to dismantle the territory's educational infrastructure. Gada Ibrahim has a report.
Students have begun returning to the shattered campuses of Gaza's universities, reopening notebooks among collapsed lecture halls in another act of defiance against the near-total collapse of the territory's higher education system.
The Islamic University is back to schooling today, sending a strong message of hope and determination. During the genocidal war, the Israeli army has deliberately destroyed most of the university's buildings and facilities. However, for us and for our people, education is a priority despite all the challenges. Now we've managed to reopen engineering, sciences, and nursing sections.
The devastation is perhaps most evident at the Islamic University of Gaza, once the largest academic institution in the territory, where buildings have been reduced to rubble, laboratories destroyed, and libraries set ablaze.
We are back to school again. Despite the challenges and the crises unfolding in every aspect of life, despite the transportation crisis and the lack of possibilities, we insist to continue learning. It is their target to decimate our education systems, but we are here to challenge them.
The students have returned, despite the challenges of lacking learning materials, electricity, and coming on foot from distant areas.
Today marks our first day back after 2 years of genocide. The university lies in ruins, yet we are eager to return and continue the educational journey we began. The challenges are immense, both for the institution and for us as students. We navigate destroyed roads with great difficulty from our displacement areas, but there is a sense of relief in finally reclaiming a normal life.
In the ruins of Gaza's shattered campuses, the act of learning has become an assertion of existence, an insistence that even amid wreckage, an educated future is still worth striving for. Adam Rahim, Gaza City, Palestine.
Moving on to Iraq now, where the country has launched an urgent investigation after Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah resistance groups mistakenly appeared on its funds freeze list for terrorism. A publication, Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani says contain inaccurate language and does not reflect state policy.
In a shocking development, Iraq's official newspaper published a set of government decisions, the most notable of which was the freezing of assets belonging to Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemeni's Ansarullah resistance groups, and listing them as a terrorist organization. The Iraqi government quickly issued a statement, though the Prime Minister Mohammed Shia Sudani denying the decision, while directing an urgent investigation to identify those who were responsible for the mistake.
I believe what happened is a mistake that affects the dignity, will, and conscience of Iraq and Iraqis. Acknowledging the mistake is good, but addressing those responsible, punishing them, and investigating those behind them is necessary. At the same time, there should be vigilance because in the future, there might be greater embarrassment for the government and state, which could harm the reputation of the Iraqi people.
As Sudani affirmed that the Iraqi government is dealing with this error with a full seriousness, stressing that it does not reflect Iraq's real position and that the corrective measures must be taken to fix the course and prevent such mistakes from reappearing in official decisions in the future. Meanwhile, observers believe that this list may have been an attempt to court the United States.
We were taken by surprise in media and political circles when a decision emerged from the Anti-Money Laundering Committee, formed by the General Secretariat of the Council of Ministers, whose outcomes were published in the official newspaper. Upon verification, it became clear that the decision included placing Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah on the terrorism list and freezing their assets. Such a classification contradicts the policy of the Iraqi government, goes against the sentiments and fundamental principles of the Iraqi people, and is inconsistent with the guidance of the religious authorities, which have repeatedly stressed the importance of supporting the Palestinian cause.
The Iraqi Central Bank issued a statement removing Hezbollah and Ansarullah from the list, but a wave of questions has emerged in Iraq about how such incorrect wording made its way into an official document, and as attention turns to the result of the investigation ordered by the Prime Minister, the major question remains, how did these errors reach the official gazette, and what are the potential political implications?
Between denials and political reaction, the most important question remains, was the list issued by the Iraqi government under American pressure following the recent official visit of the U.S. State Department, or was it a mistake as described in the Prime Minister Mohammed Shah Sudani's statement? Nawar Faik, Baghdad.
Moving on to New York now, where Iran's UN ambassadors told the General Assembly that unilateral coercive measures constitute clear violation of international law and are tantamount to crimes against humanity. Amir Saeed Iravani said those illegal actions violate human rights principles as they affect daily lives of civilians, including women and children. He added that such measures deprive people of access to medical necessities and other basic needs. Iravani also urged Secretary General Antonio Guterres to appoint a special advisor on unilateral coercive measures. His remarks came as December the 4th marked the International Day Against Unilateral Coercive Measures. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has commented on today as well. Ismail Baghaei said the U.S. must be held accountable for committing crimes against humanity through the application of illegal and inhumane sanctions against developing countries, including Iran. And Russia's President Vladimir Putin is on a state visit to India. Earlier today, Putin was officially welcomed by the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. Putin received a guard of honor at the presidential palace in New Delhi. Following the ceremony, the two leaders held talks. The Russian president touched down in India on Thursday for a two-day visit. The agenda of the trip includes defense and technology cooperation. The trip comes against a backdrop of growing pressure from the U.S. on India to reduce its reliance on Russian energy. Washington has accused New Delhi of funding the Ukraine war by purchasing discounted Russian oil. The U.S. has slapped an additional penalty on tariffs on Indian exports as New Delhi ramp up its purchases of Russian oil in the past 3 years. A new survey shows morale inside America's diplomatic corps has collapsed, with most of the U.S. diplomats reporting worsening conditions under President Trump. According to data obtained from the American Foreign Service Association, 98% of professional diplomats reported poor morale. More than 80% said it has become harder to carry out U.S. foreign policy under Donald Trump. The findings highlight the concerns expressed for months by career diplomats and foreign policy experts about the impact of Trump's changes to the State Department and foreign assistance programs. Large-scale layoffs, shrinking resources, and politicization of workforce are among the problems the U.S. Foreign Service has been facing since Trump came into office in his second term. And to get an insight into that topic, we're now joined by Mr. Emmanuel Patrick, President of Asia Institute, joining us live from Tokyo. Welcome to the program. I find it interesting that you are talking to us from Tokyo, because we do know that the U.S., even with its ally, has not really been fair. And when we talk about how the U.S., under Donald Trump especially, has been treating both its allies and those the U.S. consider as, you know, adversary, has been really upscale. Give us your intake on what's been happening.
Well, in the specific case of relations with Japan and South Korea, it's clear that the Trump administration and a large number of Americans in government and in finance see those two countries primarily as rivals. And that's related to America's decline in basic science research, its lack of competitiveness, and finally, the damaging effect of immigration policy, which has made it impossible to get the best people to come to America for research. So that's the shift. The specifics, of course, of this decline in diplomacy is related to this effort essentially to destroy the federal government, to fire or dismiss or marginalize everyone with specialized knowledge in the government as a way to basically create complete control by a handful of people.
Okay, many have said that regardless of what you think about the United States, its diplomacy has always been rock solid, and it knows how to balance, you know, using diplomacy or using the, you know, threats of war or sanction. But when it comes to the Trump administration specifically, it seems that the Trump's, you know, whims is overriding the proper channel of communication, especially among diplomats. What do you think, and we've seen some, you know, outspoken statements from many career diplomats in the U.S. State Department saying that what the Trump administration is doing goes against even American interests. What does that mean in the long run for the U.S.?
Right. Well, it's both. What's happened since February, when the Trump administration came in full force, firing basically everyone with any competence left and right, reducing the budgets for everything, has been catastrophic. And it's unprecedented in American history. I mean, what's happening right now, the sort of statements of the president and people in State Department calling people from other countries garbage, never happened in American history. However, the slow destruction of diplomacy, of education in the United States has been going on for the last 40 years, and Trump administration is the consequence of that. But under Obama, under Biden, back to the Bush administration, we've seen a slow process in which the economy and international relations have been militarized, and the people who are actually good at cultural, educational efforts to build solidarity and common values have been marginalized. And this is the very sad consequence. And this is actually quite common in the process of declining empires, whether it's the end of the Ottoman Empire, or the end of the Roman Empire, or or other empires, this is the trend you tend to get at the very end.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your views with us. That was Professor Mr. Emmanuel Patrick, President of Asia Institute, joining us from Tokyo. It's always a pleasure to have you on. And that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. As always, more is on our website to keep you updated. Thank you so much for joining us. Goodbye for now.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, it's now time for a short lecture by Sheikh Mahdi Rastani.
We reached verse 18 of Surah Al-Hashr. Ya ayyuhal ladina amanu, ittaqullah, O you who believe, fear Allah, wal tandur nafsun ma qaddamat lighadin. And every soul should think about what he has sent forward for himself. Wattaqullah. And the verse again says, fear Allah. Inna Allaha khabirun bima ta'amaloon. For Allah knows very well what it is that you do. And we said that this verse talks about this idea, this exercise that you and I have to go through, where we think about what we've sent forward for ourselves. What is it? If I were to leave right now, what are some of those deeds that I could use and ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, say, Ya Allah, I did this, and I did this. And how many of those deeds that I did, how many of them can I pinpoint and say, this one I did with the right intention. This one I didn't do because I wanted other people to see it. And this one I didn't do because I wanted other people to praise me. I did it only for you. How many? If you and I wanted to make a list of this, how long would this list even become? This is a question we have to ask ourselves. This is a question that the human being has to constantly go through this exercise. That is not to say that if you do something in the presence of others, or you tell someone else about what you have done, that this deed is definitely done without a sincere intention. No. Intention is far more nuanced than that. Just because you do something in the presence of others doesn't mean that this intention is the wrong intention necessarily. The Prophet did so many deeds, he did it in the presence of others. Our Imams did so many deeds, they did it in the presence of others. So it's nuanced. But this is a question we have to ask ourselves. When I did it in the presence of others, did I do it for the right reasons or not? Okay. The next verse moves on, and the next verse is very beautiful, and one that I want to take some time to really delve into. This is verse 19. He says, وَلَا تَكُونُوا, and don't be like these people. This is a common thread in the verses of the Qur'an, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala commonly says, don't end up like these guys. وَلَا تَكُونُوا كَالَّذِينَ is a common phrase that comes up over and over again. Yes, sometimes you sit with your parents. What do your parents say? Say, listen, make sure you don't end up like this person. Make sure you don't end up like that person. This is what the Quran is saying. And don't be like these people, because these people, they have issues. These people, they have problems, so don't end up like this. Okay, so who are these people I'm not supposed to end up like? He says, وَلَا تَكُونُوا كَالَّذِينَ. Don't be like those people. نَسُوا اللَّهَ فَأَنْسَاهُمْ أَنفُسَهُمْ. Don't be like those people who forgot God, and because of that, Allah made them forget themselves. Don't be like that person who forgets God, and the consequence of that is that Allah makes him forget who he is. And then the verse ends with this. أُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْفَاسِقُونَ. Those are the ones who openly sin. They give themselves a green light to commit sins. Yes? Fisq means a person who commits big sins, he commits it openly, he doesn't care. This is fasiq. So what is the verse saying here? The verse is saying, listen, if you are amongst fasiqoon, if you end up in that position where you sin and you do as you wish, guess what's going to happen? You are going to forget Allah. And because you are forgetting Allah, you will end up in a position where you will forget who you yourself are. You will lose your identity. You won't even know who you are in life. Many of us identify with different things in this world. I identify with my ethnicity, for example. Yeah? They ask you, who are you? You say, well, I'm Iranian. I'm Pakistani. I'm Indian. I'm Arab, whatever the case might be. Yes, I'm American, whatever the case might be. Or we identify, for example, with our careers. Or we identify in this part of the world, they identify with which college they attended. Now, who cares what college you attended, but it's a thing. Yes? Oh, Texas A&M, I don't know, this, that. Okay, whatever the case might be, right? You identify with these colleges. And none of these are haram. All of them are completely fine. Yes? But at the end of the day, all of these identities seem to just go away in your relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And your relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you only identify with one thing. And that is exactly the same thing they will identify you and I when they're doing Salatul Mayyit with us. When that day comes, inshallah, after 120 years, after we've done a good job in this world, yes? Then they want to do Salatul Mayyit. They want to identify you. They want to say, oh Allah, we're bringing this servant to you. Yes, now he's going to move on to you. You're going to take care of him from now on. So how do they identify us when those moments come? Do they say, okay, well, this person, oh Allah, this is a Pakistani servant of yours. This is an Iranian servant of yours. This is the one who went to Texas A&M. This is the one who had the top career. This is the one who was top notch in their corporation. None of these are bad things, by the way. They're all wonderful things. But this is now not how fundamentally you identify yourself. What do they say when they have mayyits? They want to now send him to Allah. He needs a pass. He needs a title. They want to identify him to these angels that are now taking him. What do they say? They say, Allahumma. They say, oh Allah, inna hadha abduka wa ibn abdik. Oh Allah, this is your servant, and he's a son of another one of your servants. What happened to all of those titles and all of those identifiers and all of those, he grew up here and his parents were this and he came from this family and all of, what happened to all of it? It all disappeared. They say, Allahumma inna hada abduka wabnu abdik wabnu amatik. He's a son of one of your male servants, a son of one of your female servants. This is who he is. Okay, so how do you differentiate between this person and all the other mayyits? The other mayyits are also son of fulan and son of fulan. Yes? So how do you differentiate between them? They continue. They say, "In kana muhsinan, fazid fi ihsan." Oh Allah, if he did good in this world, then add to his good. "Wa in kana musian, fatajawaz an." So the only differentiator, the only categorization that happens, is what? Is he muhsin or is he musi? What about all those other things? All those other things are functions of this world, and there's no problem with regards to them. Yes? The Quran says, وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ شُعُوبًا وَقَبَائِلًا لِتَعَارَفُ. We made you into these tribes so that you would be able to identify each other. If everyone came from the same country, imagine how confusing things would become. Then you wanted to identify someone, you only identify them with their fingerprints. It's the only thing that would be different at that point, right? If everyone's born in the same city, how are you going to be able to identify them? Now you say, oh, do you know Muhammad? Muhammad from where? Muhammad from Houston. Muhammad from Dallas. You say, oh yeah, I know that Muhammad. From Seattle, you say, I know that Muhammad. You identify. There's no problem with regards to these things. But none of these things count when the time comes. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is saying, this is how you have to identify. But the one who ends up sinning, he loses this identifier for himself in this world. And because he loses this identifier, he is always lost in life. He doesn't know who he is. He starts to identify with other things. He starts to identify with the car, starts to identify with the money, he starts to identify with the fame and the likes and the clicks. He starts to identify with different things that the world has to offer to him. And trust me, this world has a lot of things to offer to us. It's a lot of things. At one age, it's one thing. You get a little bit older, it becomes a different thing. Get a little bit older, it becomes a different thing. Dunya has a lot of things to offer to us. He starts to identify with those things. But here's the problem. Because he identifies with those things now, and he assumes that those things are part of who he is, when they ask him to leave this dunya now, when they ask him to go, when they ask him to leave behind this stuff, it feels like a part of him is being left behind. It feels like he's being torn apart. Why? Because this is who he is. He is the one who owns the car. He is the one who owns the business. He is the one who owns the real estate. He is the one who is the spotlight of attention, of fame, whatever the case might be. Now this angel of death is coming and telling him, give that up, now we have to go. He feels like they're tearing him apart. They feel like a part of his heart is left behind. Because this wealth was who he was. This fame was who he was. This is the way he used to look at things. This is how he used to identify with things. And this is why it becomes very difficult for a disbeliever to leave this world. Why? Because this world was who he was. This was his whole identity. Now you're pulling him away. Now it's difficult for him to give up his soul. And God forbid we end up like this. The stronger his faith becomes, the less he identifies with this world. The less he identifies with this world, the easier this process becomes.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
We want peace, but peace with sovereignty, peace with equality, peace with freedom. We do not want the peace of slaves, nor do we want the peace of colonies. Never colonies, never slaves.
The statements by the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro Moros, are in response to the multiple attacks facing the Bolivarian Republic. Maduro was addressing crowds of his supporters outside the presidential palace in Caracas. He warned that Venezuela will resist any attempt to impose a political change by force. Meanwhile, the national government denounced the theft of Citgo Petroleum Corporation by a U.S. court, together with sectors of the Venezuelan extreme right, as part of an operation to plunder the assets of the Venezuelan people.
La empresa Citgo.
Citgo is a valuable asset of Petróleos de Venezuela, which the U.S. government intends to plunder by means of legal proceedings that are clearly contrary to law.
De un procedimiento judicial.
Precisely, the Venezuelan government previously denounced before OPEC that the Trump administration is attempting to provoke regime change in order to seize its assets and oil reserves, the largest in the world. For this reason, the National Assembly defends the national sovereignty over this resource and its industry.
But we in this caucus, all the parliamentarians here are going to vote in favor of this draft agreement because when the homeland is in danger, anything is permitted except not defending it.
The amount of resources that have been plundered from the country cannot be described at this time.
Parliamentarians, in line with the government and its defense of natural resources, approved this draft agreement that condemns the theft from the people orchestrated by the most radical and submissive opposition, as well as by the United States government and its multiple attacks on the Bolivarian Republic.
From all instances, Venezuela stands resolute to maintain its independence and to preserve its resources. Those are the premises that are the cornerstone of the Bolivarian Revolution and the current policies by the government facing new forms of attacks. Gladys Casara, Caracas, Venezuela.
Today is the third and final day of that judicial review in this court. It's in fact a legal challenge brought by the direct action group Palestine Action against its prescription by the Labor government in July this year. Last month, the judges heard from the representatives of the Palestine Action group, but today, the final day, the judges are hearing from lawyers representing the Interior Ministry, known to Britons as the Home Office. But here is how we got here.
Set up in 2020, Palestine Action's stated goal is to end global participation in Israel's genocidal and apartheid regime. It's mainly targeted weapons factory, especially those belonging to the Israeli group Elbit Systems. In July this year, activists protesting against Israel's genocidal war on Gaza broke into an Air Force base in southern England, causing, the government claims, more than $9 million in damage to two aircraft. Days later, then-Home Secretary Yvette Cooper declared the group a terrorist entity, effectively making membership or support for the group a criminal offense. The ban took effect in July 5th.
It's a massive, massive overreaction and, frankly, an act of state repression to stop the people from mobilizing in a way that they feel is detrimental to their financial interests.
Seeing this as an attack on their civil liberties, thousands have since come out in a string of rallies, holding up signs reading these words. At least 2,300 have been arrested, more than 200 charged with offenses that carry up to 6 months in prison. Earlier this year, Palestine Action's co-founder, Huda Amouri, requested and won permission for a judicial review of the ban at this court, for the court to see if the ban was lawful, if the Home Office followed the correct procedure before proceeding to proscribe the group. In October, the government tried and failed to block the challenge going ahead. And last month, after days of nationwide sign-holding protests, the judicial review finally began. But at the last minute, Martin Chamberlain, the judge due to hear the legal challenge, was replaced by a panel of three judges without explanation. Two of those replacement judges have links that campaigners say raised the appearance of a conflict of interest.
The case against some of the most formidable foes in the world, the British state, the Israeli state, the weapons industry, these are not people who are going to take this lightly. So it doesn't surprise me that they're willing to sabotage the process.
Dame Victoria has familial links to prominent pro-Israel lobbyist and major Labour Party donor Trevor Chin and the group Quilliam, which has been widely condemned as Islamophobic and for supporting far-right agitator Tommy Robinson. And Justice Jonathan Swift, who dismissed WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange's extradition appeal back in 2023, has represented the Home Office, which is the defendant in this judicial review, on more than one occasion.
A judgment is expected at a later date, but if the judges in this court find in favor of Palestine Action, the group could potentially be deprescribed. The charges against its many supporters will have to be dropped, and not only that, it'll be a huge embarrassment for the British government that the pro-Palestine demonstrators in the country accuse of participation in Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Pakistan's Defense Minister Khwaja Asif has said that Muslim countries should revisit their diplomatic stance on Gaza, arguing that incessant Israeli ceasefire violations have undermined peace efforts. His comments come as several regional governments express frustrations over the failure of internationally backed agreements to halt military operations. Officials in Islamabad say any reassessment would aim to push for a more reliable framework that prevents future breaches. The idea of a collective Muslim response has been gaining traction in recent weeks, particularly as the Gaza humanitarian concerns deepen.
Daily ceasefire violations are occurring by the Israeli forces, and Muslim Ummah needs to be united and have one solution with one voice, but they are not raising their voices against the Israelis.
Countries across West Asia have been consulting one another on possible political steps, including coordinated pressure through regional bodies. Observers say the broader question is whether Muslim-majority states can unify around a position strong enough to influence future negotiations. Pakistan's call reflects a wider debate over the limits of current mediation efforts. They point out any new approach would require consensus among key regional actors and a clearer mechanism for enforcing commitments on all sides and a more sustainable political roadmap for Gaza.
What will Israel do? Will it continue to violate the ceasefire? This is an existential question for all the countries who have agreed to this U.S.-backed solution. How long will they allow Israel to kill innocent Palestinian children? No, they will reconsider.
The debate points to a wider re-evaluation underway throughout the Muslim world, suggesting that Gaza's future may hinge on a new coordinated regional strategy that could reshape the way the conflict is addressed. Khanwa Muhyiddin, Islamabad.
The UN General Assembly officially established International Solidarity Day in 1977 to express its concern about the continuing plight of the Palestinian people.
Despite the ceasefire, it is still an ongoing genocide. So the special thing is we're trying to bring to the attention of the international community about the plight of the Palestinian people, not only the genocide in Gaza, but also the terror of the settlers in the West Bank.
Speakers stressed that the Palestinian people have not yet achieved their inalienable right as defined by the General Assembly, namely the right to self-determination and national independence, among other things.
The occupation has no moral limits, but during the past 2 years, the Palestinian people have shown their resistance, which made Israel a pariah state. This is what we celebrate on this day. The project for Palestinian nationhood will not come to an end because the Arab states support it.
Representatives and ambassadors from dozens of UN member states expressed their support for Palestine, while many criticized UN Security Council for its inaction to end the Gaza genocide. On November 17th, the Security Council adopted Resolution 2803, which endorsed US President Donald Trump's so-called peace plan for Gaza.
The document contains several deeply problematic elements. Israel's obligations as an occupying power, including the renunciation of annexation of Palestinian lands and the withdrawal of its forces, are not enshrined. Resolution 2803, adopted by the UN Security Council, does not vest it with the necessary prerogatives to maintain peace and security.
The United Nations Security Council, which would have the powers and the authority to take coercive measures against such extreme violations of international order and international law has been paralyzed because what is written in its own charter, namely the veto right. In this particular case of mainly, not only, but mainly, I mean the veto privilege enjoyed by the United States.
The Day of Solidarity at UN concluded with a cultural program featuring the Palestinian choir, Shatat, screenings of Gaza documentaries and Palestinian cuisine.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people at UN headquarters in Vienna concludes a series of events and demonstrations over the past days and weeks. Cultural events, diplomatic meetings and protests were well attended by representatives and people from around the world. However, diplomats from Western states remained largely absent from any shows of solidarity with the Palestinians. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
On the second leg of his first foreign trip as head of the Catholic Church, Pope Leo XIV is in Lebanon for a visit, which he said carries a message of peace.
At times, humanity looks at the Middle East with a sense of trepidation and disheartenment in the face of such complex and long-standing conflicts. Yet in the midst of these struggles, a sense of hopefulness and encouragement can be found when we focus on what unites us, our common humanity, and our belief in a God of love and mercy.
During an interreligious event at Martyrs Square in central Beirut, the Pope listened to representatives from many of Lebanon's 18 officially recognized religious denominations. The Shia cleric asked the Pope to advocate for an end to Lebanon's years-long struggle in the face of Israeli aggression.
We are believers of the significance of the authority of the state, but in its absence, we were forced to defend ourselves and face Israel, which invaded our land. It is not our hobby to take up arms or sacrifice our sons. We therefore put our cause in your hands with what you have of international influence. Perhaps the world can help us out of our crises, primarily the Israeli aggression and its impacts.
Outside the official gatherings, believers await Pope Leo on the main roads to catch a glimpse of the revered figure.
It's a good opportunity to see Pope Leon 14 in our country, and we pray with him for the peace in Lebanon and the Middle East.
The Pope is handling with him a message of peace, a message of love, a message of honor for the country. We are honored to be to him to be with us.
The Pope's recognition of the importance of Lebanon's religious pluralism is considered pivotal, especially at this juncture in time. At the same time, experts believe his visit will most probably not be helpful for Lebanon when it comes to tangible action.
The visit will end within 2 days, and I don't think it will have much impact. We might witness a rise of tension by the Israelis. This is what they have been threatening of, and all we can count on is the capacity of the resistance to word of threats. We cannot, we don't have any other option. No calls for peace, no calls for normalization would have any effect with such a ferocious and criminal enemy such as Israel.
During his visit to Beirut, Pope Leo XIV has prayed for peace in Lebanon and the wider region. However, many fear that his visit is merely a show of symbolic solidarity, one that will neither halt the Israeli aggression against Lebanon, nor will it end the wave of U.S. intimidation targeting the political leadership. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
For weeks, tensions in the Caribbean have been intensifying. The latest flashpoint came after President Donald Trump posted on his Truth Social account that Venezuelan airspace should be considered closed in its entirety. Venezuela quickly slammed the move. The country's foreign minister denounced the move, calling it a colonialist threat and an unjustified aggression against the people of Venezuela.
Venezuela denounces and condemns the colonialist threat that seeks to affect the sovereignty of its airspace, constituting an illegal and unjustified aggression against the people of Venezuela.
As tensions rise over Venezuelan airspace, Washington faces mounting criticism abroad and at home. Cuba and Iran join in condemning Washington's posture, but more is expected from neighboring countries whose silence so far has raised questions about how the region will respond to escalating U.S.-Venezuela tensions.
But, you know, I think most of the pressure lays on the shoulders of the neighboring countries, and that's to say Brazil, and that's to say also Colombia.
On Capitol Hill, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer issued a sharp warning accusing President Trump of reckless actions that could push America into another costly foreign war. He said, Americans are tired of endless foreign wars that cost the lives of countless American service members and drain precious resources. So what is Washington's goal? The U.S. claims its actions are aimed at fighting cartels and drug trafficking. But analysts argue the real objective is to force Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro from power, either through pressure or the threat of military force.
And so there's a lot already in the region, and if there's even more on top of that, then one would think either that capability is going to be used or it's all sort of trying to demonstrate to President Maduro that it's either you leave the regime now and perhaps dictate some terms that are somewhat agreeable, or there will be a full-scale military operation to unseat you.
The U.S. has a long history of intervention in Latin America and the Caribbean, from Panama to El Salvador to Cuba. Critics say the latest pressure campaign against Venezuela fits that pattern, with troops already positioned in the Caribbean and rhetoric heating up. The standoff is no longer just about Venezuela's skies. It's about whether America is prepared to risk a wider conflict in its own backyard.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with school and university students. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi Husayniyah on November 3, 2025, on the eve of Student Day and the National Day of Fighting Global Arrogance. From the time of the Constitutional Revolution till roughly 40 years later, our country was either in a state of chaos and turmoil, it was subject to the meddling of foreign governments, or it was under the brutal, merciless despotism and dictatorship of Reza Khan. This lasted for about 42 years, which means the Iranian nation lived in such a state for several decades. Around 1949 or 1950, certain events unfolded in the country. By God's grace, a national government was formed for the first time in the country, the government of Mossadegh. It was a national government. A national government was formed that stood up to the British. Britain, at the time, was in effect the ruler of the world. It was more superior, stronger, and bigger than all other powers. The country's oil was being given to the British almost for free. It was taken back from them, and using the language of that time, it was nationalized. This means that it was brought under the control of our own government, and a national government was established in Iran. During the 3 years from 1950 to 1953, the conspiracies of the British and their allies brought immense pressure on this government in order to overthrow it. Mossadegh was naive and made an unwitting mistake. In order to free himself from the British, he turned to the US and asked them for help. The US smiled at him. Of course, there was the precedent of Truman's Point 4 program, and there were other similar policies too, which led him to believe that the United States would support him. The US smiled at Mossadegh, but behind his back, they took advantage of Mossadegh's oversight and inattention. They colluded with the British, they orchestrated a coup, and they overthrew the national government that had been formed in the country after 40 years. They then brought back the Shah, who had fled the country. This was a severe blow to the Iranian nation. The meaning of the 28th of Mordad is precisely this. It means that a government elected by the people, which did not want to be at the disposal of Britain and foreign colonialism, and wanted to be a national government, was toppled and destroyed by the US through their use of all sorts of tricks.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, to Iran Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, broadcasting from the heart of our capital, Tehran. To begin, we invite you to stay with us for today's special, a daily program dedicated to commemorating various Islamic and Iranian occasions with a blend of beautiful Quranic verses, heartfelt prayers, uplifting nasheeds, and insightful reports. This show creates a space for reflection and connection. Don't miss the opportunity to join us in this spiritual journey. After that, take a moment to immerse yourself in Hadith of the Day. Every day, Sheikh Muhammad Ja'far Danish will present a fresh Hadith from the Holy Prophet and his noble family, peace be upon them. Along with each Hadith, he will offer brief yet thought-provoking commentary that resonate with our lives, often aligned with key dates on the Islamic or solar calendar. It is a chance to reflect and renew your spirit. Next, we've prepared a selection of some of our finest radio productions filled with stories and soundscapes designed to enrich